Welcome back to the Resilient Futures Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Resilient Futures Podcast. You're here today with your hosts, myself, Alicia Homerick, and Todd Bridges. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Alicia. I'm quite excited to be talking about bugs and bunnies today.
Great. We have two amazing guests with us. We have Charles Van Rees and Kyle McKay, both of which have recent publications on biodiversity, the overarching theme of today's episode. These articles will be linked in the description as always, but first, Kyle and Charles, let's get to know each of you a little bit more. Can you tell us about yourself, what you do, maybe how you got to that current role as well? Kyle, how about you start us off?
Cool. Thanks for having me, Alicia and Todd. I'm excited to be here today. And I've been enjoying listening to the Resilient Futures podcast, and it's fun to participate. My background is a bit of an unusual one, or you could say it's very standard. This is the family business for me. So I'm a child of civil servants. My dad worked for the VA, and my mom worked for the Corps of Engineers and NOAA and FEMA. So I am a child of civil engineers, obviously not a very rebellious one. So I came to civil engineering through Colorado State and University of Illinois, and then I did a PhD at the University of Georgia in ecology. And I work on integrated water resource management. I'm lucky to lead a team of folks working on that topic through lenses like engineering and ecology and social science. And we try to work on the sticky problems of how to make trade-offs. So I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Charles.
Yeah, good morning, Alicia. Good morning, Todd. Great to be here with you. Same as Kyle. Really, really excited to be a part of this and contribute to the podcast. I think that the information and the messages you're sending are super important. And it's really great also to get biodiversity on the map and on that menu of items and themes coming forward through the podcast. So we were talking about kind of how we got into this field and where we're coming from. I'm definitely coming from a very biodiversity heavy background. For a long time now, I've considered myself a naturalist. So I've been really interested in the natural world and understanding the history and the interest and all of the difference in variety in the natural world. It's just always been something that I found very fulfilling and fascinating. And there's always more to learn, which is tremendously exciting. As a professional, I started working in conservation science maybe 15 years ago, specializing in endangered species management and broadly wildlife conservation. Undergraduate degree in that, worked kind of as an itinerant field biologist for a couple of years, and then started a PhD at Tufts University up in New England, which is where I grew up. And in that process, I started getting more and more interested in water issues. I saw fresh water as kind of a major uniting factor and a major kind of flashpoint for a lot of really difficult and complicated and fascinating conservation issues. And I got really interested in wetlands. I did my PhD on water birds and wetlands in the Hawaiian Islands, and joined an interdisciplinary program in water diplomacy there, focusing a lot of these same issues that Kyle's talking about, but coming from a very wildlife and organism and ecosystem focused direction. And that got me more and more talking with engineers and agriculture experts and water policy folks from this totally different perspective of like, hey guys, like, what about the ducks? What about the marshes? Whatever it was. And that sort of led this kind of the spinning off of my career more in this direction since then. And it's been so exciting to be really, you know, how I would define it now is as an interdisciplinary conservation scientist. Like, my traditional training is in wildlife management and animal behavior and landscape ecology. But now I spend all my time hanging out with engineers and economists and climate risk analysts and things like that. And it's a tremendously exciting field, as I'm sure we'll go into in this episode. There's a lot happening that gives me a tremendous amount of hope for the future.
Well, thanks for that introduction, Charles and Kyle. And we're here today, we're going to be talking about biodiversity. But before we get into, you know, probing the depths of your work in this space, it's good to start with defining terms. So, Charles, maybe you tell us, you know, what is biodiversity?
An amazing question to start with here. I hear this question a lot, even just, you know, in very non-academic settings. I work also some of the time as a nature guide, and I end up spitting out this term all the time because it captures in a really smart way, I think, so much of what we understand and value about nature. But then people are always like, yeah, but what does that really mean? And the first thing that comes out of my mouth is always stuff that's different in the natural world. Meaning the richness, the variety of different things, whether those are happenings, phenomena, or entities that you can witness in the natural world, that richness, all of that variety is encompassed in biodiversity. And it always sounds kind of poetic to put it that way. But I think it's really meaningful to consider that anything that's different from something else and is occurring in nature is a form of biodiversity. And so the next thing from there becomes, how do we value that? But I'm going to flip this over to Kyle and see if he has any more illuminating words to pop in here.
No, not. I don't have a different view than Charles. I may think about it slightly differently. So I think about biodiversity like a cake or like baking. So we can talk about a pile of flour, a pile of sugar, some milk and eggs, but isn't it more interesting to talk about how those things make cookies and cakes and pies? And that's how I think about biodiversity, is it's the parts which are interesting in their own right, but the thing they make together that makes it really special. That is the least ecological definition of biodiversity you will ever hear, but I'm obviously a food-motivated guy.
Well, we share that in common, that's for sure. Anytime you can use a dessert metaphor, you've got my attention. So on this topic, one way that we'll see this expressed by diversity is number of species. And there are different estimates. It's kind of interesting to even consider the fact that scientists are still probing, you know, how many species there are, distinct species there are on the planet. And if you were to look into this a little bit more, you'll see that there's a lot kind of focused in around this kind of 8 to 10 million species on the planet. And when we start thinking about the importance of biodiversity, maybe we can probe that idea just quickly. Why is it important? And think about it in these terms. Well, if we have 8 to 10 species on the planet, what does it matter if you lose one or two here or there? Now, you know, we need to pipe in the collective gasp that would be associated with asking a question like that. But I think that will help solidify, well, why is biodiversity important? Kyle, maybe start with you.
You're asking a really classic ecological question, right? Like, since G. Hutchinson and what's the classic paper, Homage to Santa Rosalia, why are there so many species? It is one of the fundamental questions that's driven ecology for 50 years. So why do we care? I would say that biodiversity is the texture and richness of the world, that a world made of many species provides many beautiful things to look at, many ecosystem services, many ways for us to interact with those other species. I think it's overly simplifying to put us humans and society that is in the middle of everything, that it's far more interesting to think of us as part of this broader community that's working together to create this wonderful place we live. Charles, any thoughts there?
Sure. I love the way you put that, Kyle. And I think that you're capturing in that explanation sort of a couple of the different arguments that I always like to bring forward with this. My go-to on a lot of these issues, and especially ones as complex as the value of biodiversity, tend to be very pluralist. I think there are a lot of different ways and justifications that we can use to value biodiversity, understand why it's something that's so valuable to so many people, and why it's so important that we do something about this ongoing biodiversity crisis. However, I think it's, like you said, it's a bit limiting to say, oh, there's only one way of thinking about it. We know, for example, we have an increasing appreciation for things like ecosystem services or nature's contributions to people. There are things that biodiversity and functioning ecosystems do for us that are worth tons of money. If you just want to think about money, they're really useful to us. But beyond that, you know, what right do we have to say, you know, what's the one way to value biodiversity? Different cultures and different people connect with nature in many different ways all over the world. And those are equally legitimate. There's no reason to say, oh, this is worth a dollar, so that is more meaningful than this person's personal connection to a certain type of tree. How do we get to say that? So my perspective has always been there are so many different ways, some of them based on economics, some of them based on personal or spiritual connections, some of them based on I just like knowing that tigers exist. And I think those are all perfectly valid and very, very important. But if you're, you know, really a brass tacks type of person and you want to know, what is nature doing for me? That literature is out there. We know that you know, rich and biodiverse ecosystems are the reason that life is supportable on Earth. We know that that's, you know, one of our main protections against the next pandemic. We know that, you know, that's how we get a lot of our most important agricultural crops through natural pollination processes, things like that, on and on and on. So that the literature is substantial, the knowledge is substantial, but it's varied. And I think it's actually important to embrace that, well, frankly, diversity of value on top of the diversity of life.
Right. I, you know, to continue the food metaphor a little bit, I think it's easy to ask people a question on this point to say, do you like to eat? do you like food? Well, if you like food, then you should be concerned about biodiversity, because without pollinators, people don't eat, period. Mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, in another metaphor, if you think about the Earth as a living system, and that system is a gigantic machine, the other question to ask is, well, you could look at a gigantic machine and all the wires in it. Well, what if I just pull this wire out? Hey, I just pulled that wire out and nothing seemed to happen. The question is, how many wires can you pull out before the whole thing crumbles? Yeah. So I think we've established that we, on this discussion so far, that, you know, we should be concerned about biodiversity. There's a lot of reasons why it's important.
So some of our listeners may be wondering, like, why are we valuing biodiversity in these ways? Particularly, Charles, you're beginning to mention, like, we're monetizing it. Why are we trying to figure out the monetary value of our biodiversity? And a lot of it's coming down to, like, design choices we're making and how we're designing the spaces that we live in. The entire world now is a design space, and not just for engineers. I'll disclaim, our last episode was talking about resilience and civil engineering. I have a background in engineering. There may always be this bias in this podcast because of this. But when we're making decisions in the world, it impacts all these different systems. We're making decisions based off of, like, the quality of life we want, but that's going to impact our technological design, and it's going to impact our ecological systems. And a lot of the decisions that humans have made in history have had negative consequences to the environment, to those ecological systems around them. And so both of you are working on how can we design urban systems or nature-based solutions in a way that help promote or advance biodiversity. How can we be conscious of biodiversity in our design? And Kyle, you were the lead for an article that was proposing a continuum. So thinking of design as from gray to green, from natural to conventional infrastructure, which is a topic we have explored in this podcast a couple times. Like, what does hybrid gray-green infrastructure look like? And I would love if you could contextualize this continuum in terms of biodiversity. Like, what does it mean for design to be thinking in this continuum?
Yeah, interesting question. So I think of engineering and the infrastructure community and the conservation community as being on this convergent path, right? So in the infrastructure world, 50, 100 years ago, the conversation was around dominating nature or controlling nature, as John McPhee says. But over time, that boundary has slipped, right? So then it became about designing in a way that avoids environmental damage through maybe the mitigation hierarchy. And then it became about expanding infrastructure purposes to include environmental outcomes. Then more recently, we see a lot of engineering emphasizing resilient design and embracing social and ecological resilience. On the other side of the equation, we have the conservation world that maybe started with true reserves in the sense of places like Yellowstone and Yosemite, where if we could just build enough walls around nature, we could protect it. And over time, that boundary is given way. And we have the conservation community creeping into this world of now thinking about spaces in the world for sharing and sparing. So a continuum of conservation. But what you see is both of those firm boundaries eroding in both disciplines and all of them creeping together to this place where we have environmental objectives, social objectives, all needing to be met together. And I think infrastructure could meet those objectives in different ways, that we may need conventional infrastructure sometimes. You know, we need concrete, steel, and dirt, just like we did 100 years ago in some places. And in other places, we may be able to embrace the ecosystem services provided by natural systems through, for instance, coastal wetlands attenuating waves or watersheds cleaning fresh water for cities to drink. And when we think about putting all of those pieces together to make a puzzle, that's when we start thinking about natural and conventional infrastructure working together in these big hybrid systems. Am I getting anywhere close to where you wanted me to go there, Alicia?
Yeah, you're doing great. Discussing like that history of building nature out like it wasn't part of our system and moving it in, understanding that we need to be kind of working in harmony, I think is a really good message. I guess the only thing I would tack on to this question is whether or not there's any key takeaway from your continuum being proposed message that you'd like to get out there.
I think for me, the main takeaway is just that conservation and infrastructure have often been pitted against each other in people's minds, that I think there's this urban legend that these things can't exist together, but that's really a false dichotomy. And frankly, it's a bit antiquated. And now we need to be thinking about conservation and infrastructure working together to solve both societal and environmental problems at the same time. So that's the biggest take home, I think, from our paper, is just trying to break down that boundary that people have falsely set between these two disciplines.
That sets up a great transition, I think, for the next question that we'll pose to Charles. Charles, your work and the paper you and colleagues recently published was specifically focused on the role of nature-based solutions, as we call them, in connection to biodiversity, where nature-based solutions refers to, you know, our efforts as people to combine, if you will, our engineering with nature, natural systems and structures, so that our engineering supports nature and nature supports our engineering and us. And so these ideas associated with nature-based solutions address the point that Kyle is making here, that about the false dichotomy, that we have to make a choice between engineering and what we consider to be modern civilization and nature. So could you describe this a little bit more in terms of how you set this context up in the work you've recently been doing with others?
Sure, absolutely. And it's worth noting, of course, that, you know, that these two papers were kind of designed to fit together. And these are less kind of more an effort of Kyle's or mine, and kind of both coming from our sort of larger think tank that we've been assembling at UGA and elsewhere. So these are both kind of the same people saying the same but complementary messages. I definitely want to clarify. So one of the things in my angle that I think kind of helps complement a bit of what Kyle was talking about, and that I think is a point worth bringing up, is that we've been, one thing is that this convergence that we described as a confluence between the two fields I want to make clear that that's been a very intentional thing. We're using terms like boundaries eroding and like drifting happening, but this wasn't random. Both of these fields were maturing and therefore converging in that process, right? Conservation scientists were realizing it more and more like, oh my gosh, we can't ignore people. That's not how this works. People are often a part of nature, and more so in a lot of cultures outside of our, you know, Eurocentric colonial neo-colonial capitalist point of view. Like, there are other cultures out there that connect in more meaningful ways with nature, or ways that are less destructive. When we say that, you know, infrastructure is always destructive to nature, well, our infrastructure is. Lots of other cultures throughout history have done a much better job than we have. And so, you know, I could get into some examples, but the point being that I think part of what we're doing is we are maturing as a technocratic society in two different directions that are kind of coming together in a way that might work better for the future. And we can find kind of examples from the past that have worked well. When it comes to nature-based solutions, what we're seeing from my point of view as a conservation scientist is that in taking this approach to understanding that we can't overpower certain forces in nature, especially as we're dealing with non-stationary future, climate change, these steadily exponentially increasing pressures and intense weather systems and things like that from climate change, these real threats that need to be managed. We can't just sort of command and control approach these with only hard infrastructure approaches. We know that's not going to kind of fit the bill anymore. So we're trying to embrace kind of the increased flexibility and adaptiveness that can be granted by the services that ecosystems provide. And that's, of course, the nature-based, right, part of these solutions, that we are using nature in some way, aspects of nature, to do things that provide for us. What we've been trying to emphasize, especially in this second paper that you were referencing, Todd, is that that's still just half of the coin here. That's nature benefiting us. What we are trying to advocate for is that at the same time, we should be benefiting nature in some way. And well, what does that mean? Who gets to speak for nature, right? And that becomes this issue of, okay, if we are going to start restoring or creating or protecting ecosystems because they do these things for us, because all these things that Kyle was listing, right? If we're protecting our shorelines, keeping military installations safe from sea level rise and so on and so forth, if they're doing those things for us, how do we take advantage of that process of restoring, protecting, creating new ecosystems such that it also supports biodiversity and addresses some of our major concerns about global biodiversity loss? Where are those opportunities? How do we go about doing it? And what do we need to do in order to start thinking that way, where it's not just about what is this ecosystem going to do for us, but what is this new ecosystem going to do for biodiversity as a whole, for the natural world? How do we cultivate more of a reciprocity, in a sense, between us and this larger sort of this biodiversity writ large? And that's kind of what we've been focusing on. Is that's a major paradigm shift. That's hard to think about because we don't think that way currently. What would that look like? That's kind of what we were moving forward towards. And of course, nature-based solutions are a key part of doing that.
One of the terms that you'll hear frequently, and it's a term that I really like, is nature positive outcomes. Mm. So if we think about engineering or infrastructure, how can we make those human interventions in the planet's machine nature positive? That is, we're not just trying to minimize the harm of our footprint on the planet, but we're actually creating systems and engineering in a way that actually creates positive nature outcomes. And what we're talking about today is in the context of biodiversity. But maybe Charles, you first, and then maybe Kyle, when you think about nature-based solutions, are there particular types of projects that would fit that description that you think offer considerable promise or prospect in regards to biodiversity in particular? Maybe just highlight one from your point of view.
Absolutely. I would say that I think almost all projects that are going to leverage ecosystem services have some potential, you know, for supporting biodiversity. And the basic mechanism that we're considering is mainly habitat of some form, right? Organisms use different types of habitats for different types of purposes throughout their life cycle. And we can usually provide some of those habitats in the process of creating ecosystems that we're going to use for stuff, right? Whether that's absorbing floods or filtering water or what have you. I know that you've spoken about levee setbacks on this podcast before. For me, that's probably one of the most exciting examples of a nature-based solution that, of course, we are trying to leverage them for protecting people and important assets from floods, managing more extreme rainfall regimes in the future and things like that. From a biodiversity perspective, we know that that in essence, when you are reconnecting a portion of the floodplain to a river in these levee setbacks, you are regenerating these flood disturbance regimes that support a variety of what, as ecologists, we would call disturbance-dependent or successional habitats that are really important for lots of threatened biodiversity. So that's one for me, maybe as a freshwater nerd, that's especially appealing because I see so many different benefits ecologically from doing that, in addition to obviously the major economic and ethical advantages to protecting people, right, and adapting to a changing climate. We're also doing things like potentially providing spawning habitat for rare fish, or breeding habitat for declining birds that depend on these insects that come out of the floodplains and things like that. It's a tremendous opportunity to restore very rare, and what you might call endangered ecosystems, to restore those on scales that conservation scientists could never have dreamed of, because we don't have the funding and the capacity to do that at that scale. But if we're doing that for these very different reasons, pertaining to human well-being, suddenly we open up these windows to do this at scales that for us are mind-blowing. And that's really exciting.
And Kyle, what about you? What do you think, Kyle? An example.
Interesting question. Well, it's a University of Georgia-sponsored podcast, right? So I feel the need to quote Gene Odom. And one of my favorite books of his is called Ecological Vignettes. And the entire premise of the book is, what can society learn from ecology? And one of the vignettes is titled, "When Things Get Tough, It Pays to Cooperate." And I feel like that's what we're talking about here, is that in a crowded planet, when there isn't as much space, infrastructure objectives and conservation objectives need to blend together. And as Charles said, we know that there is a lot of funding available in the infrastructure space right now. We're in the midst of a generational investment in infrastructure. The Global Infrastructure Hub estimates something on the order of $2.5 to $3 trillion a year in investment in infrastructure over the next 10 years. That's a pretty big number. It's a particularly large number relative to conservation investments, which are usually on the order of about 120 to 150 billion a year, so about a 20-fold difference. So if we think about a portion of the infrastructure investments targeting biodiversity outcomes, we could have substantial effect on biodiversity loss. And when you ask for examples, I always go back to the oldies but goodies, the ones that are in the ground for a long time and we see demonstrable benefits of both outcomes. So my favorite example of natural infrastructure is the Yolo Bypass in California, in the Central Valley. This is a floodway that protects Sacramento from floodwaters. And as the American River and Sacramento rivers rise, water flows into the Yolo Bypass during wet years and provides a wetland environment on the Pacific Flyway. During dry years, they can farm parts of the Yolo Bypass and use it for agriculture when flow conditions allow. So the bypass is providing economic opportunity, conservation outcomes, and keeping people safe. That seems like a pretty good example to me. So I like to go back to the ones we have lots of evidence on.
Yeah, the Yolo Bypass is a favorite of mine. 2 years ago, I spent a Thursday morning in December at the Yolo Bypass Wildlife Area. And I got to tell you, it was a magical morning. And there were just dozens of people out there bird watching in this kind of foggy Central Valley kind of winter day. It's only 15 minutes from downtown Sacramento, but dozens of people there on a weekday morning were out there looking at birds in this beautifully complex wetland environment. It was a fantastic personal experience. So thank you both for those responses.
The Yolo Bypass is an easy place to imagine what people have referred to in the past as the inland sea of the Central Valley during flood. It's easy to transport back because there is still that wildness that we were talking about, that texture, that life that's just thriving there. So it's a fun one to go to.
So I want to circle back. There is a component to both of your answers about scaling up nature-based solutions. Or Kyle, you mentioned there's a lot of investment going into this. Charles, you were mentioning just having a large-scale project. And so what steps do you think are necessary to have decision makers to begin thinking at larger scales rather than smaller, more project-based, nature-based solutions?
I'm going to cheat. I'm going to go to one of the great 20th century thinkers, Jane Jacobs, a classic urban planner, right? And Jane Jacobs, in her famous book in 1961, says, one of the unsuitable ideas behind projects is the very notion that they are projects, abstracted out of the ordinary city and set apart. The aim should be to get that project, that patch upon the city, rewoven back into the fabric. And in doing so, strengthen the surrounding fabric too. I think that's the goal, is to think about actions that reweave our pieces of infrastructure and conservation back into the communities where they are and make them a part of people's lives. And to the extent that we can do that, I think we will meet both of these goals head on.
That's a tough one to follow, Kyle. I have a couple thoughts on this. I mean, this is obviously something we spend a lot of time thinking about, particularly in our larger follow-up paper on this topic. I should say that from a biodiversity perspective, this issue of scale is really key. And I'm really glad that you highlighted it, because it is, if you look at the history of biodiversity conservation for however long it's been around now, in name at least, it's one of failure. I mean, we have not achieved any of the 2020 biodiversity targets. Things don't look great, and what we are doing now does not work. Everything we have done has been insufficient in its scale and ambition, to be frank. That's not to say that tons of people haven't done amazing work and that, you know, there's progress being made, but we need something entirely different than what we've been seeing in terms of the world's investment and commitment to conservation if we're going to actually achieve any of the goals that we're setting now for the next 20 plus years. And so it is really, really, really worth thinking about how we take advantage of this scaling element. And we talk about a lot of different entry points for that. One of the ones that really occurs to me quite frequently is kind of an integration across scales of governance. And this is an issue that I see coming up a lot as a conservation scientist, but also in terms of, as I learn more about water resources management, things like that, is that we have so many different levels at which decisions are being made and at which policies apply and things like that, that the needs and nuances and idiosyncrasies of the situations and people on the ground can differ very largely from the policies and big time decisions that are putting these top down influences on those systems. And this might sound in some way kind of counter to what Kyle was saying, but I think it actually falls in quite a bit, is that we need to recognize local nuance while also making sure that projects that are happening on the ground are coordinated in some way, right? By these upper level organizations and initiatives. We need to make sure that things can deal with the particular politics and culture and biodiversity of individual places, because biodiversity is in many ways a very place-based, place-specific, and idiosyncratic sort of phenomenon, that needs to be integrated with these larger initiatives. So I think if we had more attention to, hey, what, you know, what we do in terms of building a drainage swale or water treatment wetland in this small town somewhere in Iowa, that's actually, that should be considered and understood and managed as part of a larger regional or national, you know, effort to have more biodiverse or nature-based infrastructure.
One way to prompt creativity and to inspire is to ask people to think about going big. You know, if you were to go big on this, what would that involve? And some of the numbers that Kyle was citing earlier can be extrapolated by estimates of that others have made, that by mid-century, somewhere on the order of $100 trillion will be spent on infrastructure around the world. If you think about that infrastructure, all of it, being nature positive infrastructure, I mean, that it blows my mind to think about what value could be created within natural systems if $100 trillion of infrastructure was nature positive on the planet. So when you think about that kind of going big, Charles, maybe first, and then Kyle, maybe could you single out one piece of advice you might have to somebody that's working in this space or maybe is thinking about working in this space?
Absolutely. And I love this idea. I've already got kind of my concepts and imaginings rushing through my head of this idea of that much money and that, you know, that the thinking about going big. I would say that one major tool that we would need to really focus on and understand better, frankly, to do something like this at scale, to make a real biodiversity impact with that level of and that scale of investment, would be understanding oftentimes at a somewhat location-specific scale, what are the biodiversity gains you can make with different types of infrastructure investments. That involves understanding specific ecological interactions between species. That involves understanding successional dynamics, animal behavior. I mean, a lot of this really core natural history information, which I think for the last century we've been disregarding as kind of old stuff that isn't real science anymore. It's all observational. But I actually think that a lot of these sort of idiosyncratic and contingency-based aspects of local biodiversity and the specific interactions of species with their habitats are going to be so crucial now. They've been ignored for a long time. They've been seen as irrelevant. They're all coming to light now as things that we really, really need to know about these environments. Being able to tap into that knowledge will be crucial to actually make things nature positive. I think nature positive is a much bigger step than people are pointing it out to be. They think, oh, well, if we put a bunch of trees down, it'll be good for nature, right? And it's like, no, the answer is probably no to that. That's not necessarily true. If you want to be restoring, you know, the actual endemic biodiversity to a region, you need to get to know that place in some way. That sounds completely impossible from the perspective of an international entity, right, making these giant infrastructure investments. And I think that's because it is. So I think we need to have attention to knowledge of nature and take advantage of existing repositories of knowledge of nature and its relationships that we are currently ignoring and dismissing. Things like indigenous and local communities that are embedded in the ecology of these systems and understand how they work. We'll talk to them. How have they managed these ecosystems in the past in ways that have at times actually enriched the biodiversity of an area quite substantially? Can our infrastructure systems mimic or utilize some of those principles to actually achieve nature positivity? So I would say, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, if we're going to, you know, have that scale of spending and effort and momentum behind this, which I think we absolutely should, some large portion of that from the beginning needs to be about how do we actually achieve nature positive? What does that mean? You know, and that needs to be concrete. That needs to be how much habitat are you trying to establish for what species to support them in what part of their life cycle? I think we need to get that specific about conservation goals.
I agree, Charles. Todd, your question's a good one. How do we go big? Unfortunately, I think there's going to be some duality required. that we're going to have to hold two ideas in our mind at the same time. On the one hand, as Charles said, we need to be listening to communities. We need to be elevating historically unheard voices, coordinating across jurisdictions, authorities, co-producing outcomes to get everybody coordinated at the system scale. The counterpoint to that is that we need to embrace the urgency of these problems. We need to go small at the same time. We need to take decisive, courageous actions to put these features on the landscape. And along the way, we need to learn and understand their performance, understand how they perform in relation to other features on the landscape. But I think going big is going to require us to hold two ideas in our mind. Todd, I've heard you tell people we need to be able to walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. That's something I've heard you admonish me on before. And so I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to embrace your wisdom there and suggest duality is required to go big.
Yeah, thanks for that, Kyle. I want to thank you, Kyle, and Charles for your time this morning. This has been a very enjoyable conversation. And I'd further like to thank both of you for your commitment and your passion for this topic. I think it is so important for the future, and you both are leading in this space with your colleagues. I thank you very much for doing that.
I want to thank both of you. Y'all are hosting a very cool dialogue here with a lot of people about what a resilient world looks like, and it's fun to participate in it. So thank you for inviting us today.
Yeah, and thank both of you.
The Resilient Futures Podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by the University of Georgia's Institute for Resilient Infrastructure Systems, or IRIS. To learn more, please visit iris.uga.edu/resilient-future-podcast. If you have any questions, comments, feedback, or ideas for future episodes, please find us on Twitter at rfuturespod. Or contact our production manager, Sarah, at sarah.bukleitner@uga.edu. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe and drop a review wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.